I'll sail down the street in my new fancy car. I will rise through the buildings to the sky like a star. There's a house in Eden, even though I've lost my way, and I'll be there shortly. This is just a brief delay.
Good evening. And welcome to Adam's Motion in the Void. My name is Sean Hurley, and I'll be assisting Mr. Sleeves here and there and wherever may be required. Last week, Sherwin boarded a mysterious train, intent on finding a place to call home. Freshly retired from 40 years on the stage and under the influence of a philosophical book, he soon discovers the train's most unusual feature. It is a private, rather than public, train. The train's owner, Neve Kimball, not at all happy to find a stowaway on board, has the train stopped, and Sherwin is unceremoniously dropped into the Badlands of South Dakota, where we find him now, with nothing but a book and a hard bun. This evening's music is provided by Grafton, New Hampshire resident Skip Gorman. After the story, please stay tuned for my conversation with Skip. And now, the Orwell Storyteller, Part 2.
I wavered on a berm of basalt and gravel, abandoned in the South Dakota Badlands. The surrounding canyons erupted all around with broken-hearted mountains and sharp spires. There was a burned, rum sweetness in the air, the scent of the distant prairies, I supposed. I watched the gray scarf of smoke pour upward from the rusted stack of Neve Kimball's locomotive. I climbed over the rail and struggled across the wooden ties, moving as quickly as I could. If I'd been on the Titanic, I suppose I would have instantly begun swimming, willy-nilly, as though effort alone was the flare gun of rescue, as though movement was itself the essence of safety. The old train puffed into a forest of fine needles, flickering toward invisibility. It was heading toward an open V in the gorge, and would soon be out of sight. I checked my inventory. Sticky bun in one hand, book in the other. My traveler's valise had been sadly left on board the train. While I wouldn't miss the packed old socks and pants, I was troubled by the loss of my notebooks, which contained all of the stories I'd used in my one-man show, The Orwell Storyteller. When the train finally vanished into the crevasse, my body weakened, and I sat in the shadows on the silvery rail to be as near as I could to the product of civilization, a flash of well-known disasters, real and otherwise, played brightly on my skull. The Hindenburg in flames, Robinson Crusoe emaciated on his beach, the Titanic, cracked and swallowing sea. This was none of those, and yet I was feeling a probably silly kinship with the world of tragic figures. From books, I knew a little about the Badlands. There was not much in the way of vegetation, but I could expect to see a hearty juniper here or there. And if lucky, I'd find a prickly pear cactus, the fruit of the latter spiky plant, was water-soaked. In the self-created failure of yesterday, I had promised myself that today would be different. Today I would follow the path of least resistance in the mode of Keir Lowry, the former painter who had given up his celebrated life and begun what he called the discursive narrative of not being in charge. I would be a leaf on the river of life, as the book suggested, So what should the leaf do now? I wondered. The question itself was not at all leaf-like. The book often reminded one to notice one's state. What was the body saying? When tired, one should sleep. I found that I was desperately thirsty. The leaf and Mr. Lowry would search for the prickly pear, and so I did. I strode down off the tracks. The ground was a mixture of sand and baking soda. It was cake-like, and I had the impression that I was walking on wrong objects, as though I was putting boots to a well-made bed or fine dinner. I had the urge to dance away from the rejecting surface. I walked, hunting out the backs of the dusty hillocks and around the corners of the endless spars for the closest thing to a water fountain. I went beneath half-fallen arches, down gentle dips and escarpments, and came upon smaller canyons, continually arriving in similar worlds of domed, sandy pikes. As the sun paced whitely toward noon, the temperature soared, and my thirst grew. I felt the parching in my throat as a kind of scrape. I was thankful, at least, for my hat, its brim shielding my face from the intergalactic burner above. I expected the prickly pear to leap out at me, a fluorescent badge of green sewn on the yellow uniform of the sand. Because of this, I nearly missed it. Small and low to the ground, a wan, soft, lemony green patch at the base of a sequester of boulders. I had a small pocket knife and clipped off a single bulbous fruit, and then cut away the covering skin of thorns. I soon held a slippery bag of wet cactus. I took a small, distant bite, mild and bitter, a kind of wilderness dishwater. I drank and ate of it, very pleased with myself as though I had, with this minor victory, fully established my credentials as a frontiersman. I would live, I thought dramatically. I could make it. As the afternoon crept off, I clipped and ate several more of the plump fruits, before finally laying down in my anxious exhaustion, a small man between yellow boulders at the bottom of a dead canyon. I turned my hat upon my eyes and enjoyed the nearness of the felt and cloth. The sound, which soon roused me from a good nap, struck me first as the likely whining reverberation of a coming train. My hat toppled off as I shot up to peer for the source. The sound echoed around the great space, a kind of tremulous, faraway bell. It was almost evening, growing faintly dark, and I stood, dusting my hat on my leg, certain of it now. Not the sound of a train on the tracks. Not at all. This was the sound of a telephone, impossibly ringing out across the Badlands. I set my hat and hastened toward it, a leaf on the river.
Maybe slow doggies quit roaming around. You have wandered and trampled all over the ground. Great slow doggies and feet kind of slow and don't forever be on the go. Oh, moon. Circle heard it, and night heard it too, but to keep you together is what I can do. My horse's leg weary, and I'm mighty tired. But if it, I lose you, I'm sure to get fired. Bunch up a little doggies, bunch up. Oh, say, little doggie, when you go to lay down and quit this forever sifting around, my limb. Like you lay down before, lay down, little doggy, lay down. Lay still, little doggy, since you have laid down, and stretch your way out on the big open ground. Snore loud, little doggies, and drown the wild sound. That'll all go away when the day rolls around. Lay still, little doggie, lay still. Slug doggies, quit roaming around. You have wandered and trampled all over the ground. Gray slug doggies, and feed kind of slow, and don't forever be on the go. Oh, me.
The steady line of cliffs to the west rimmed orange with the falling sun. The canyon was a blue harbor, packing up with cold as night came near. I continued my slow investigation under a faint scrim of clouds. There were long hobbled stretches of openness. Undulating ways touched here and there with bone-like dunes and long tipping pipes of yellow and red stone. From the wider plain of the gorge, I followed quick as I could in the direction of the ringing telephone. I entered a broken slatwork of paths that hitched to and fro amongst each other and finally turned down a road-wide gulch. A payphone, I thought, as I drew closer. Not at all the lemonade sweetness of a home ring, but rather the shrieking, harsh grind of the street bell. The gulch blew gradually into a wider lane, and this then fell back upon a smaller, deeper plains, herded with rows of leaning pylons. Crossing outward, the cliff edges drew tightly overhead in a noose. I have never been in the mouth of a volcano, but I assume this is the aspect of an overhanging vast circumscription of the blue sky, the gathered rim of land seeming likely to close above me. As I pushed along the open space, the ringing softened. Even as I moved toward it, over the now rising sifts and mounds, it dimmed, softer and softer, until it all but faded from my ears. I stopped and listened, angling with exquisite devotion to tune in the now gone sound. I hung in the waiting air, but the ringing did not resume. I began to doubt it, and relaxed back into my body as I thought to look around now for more immediate solutions. I should find a place to sleep while there was still light. It had been foolish not to bring some of the fruits of the prickly pear, I would need to find a new plant on which to dine. I took a long breath and nearly jumped as I saw it, not 20 yards off in a tumble of brown stones. A shattered old black phone box, crooked and pummeled in the yellow dirt, as likely as a ship in a tree. I raced to the mirage and stepped inside the booth. The folding door was long gone and most of the windows missing, but the small roof above looked to have seen recent work. The antique phone was mounted chest high, its coin slot blocked with a plug of juniper twigs. I fiddled these out and patted my pockets for change. Nothing. Did I need change? I raised the handset to my ear and listened. No dial tone. I rattled the money return. Nothing. I thumbed the silver latch and listened, and then tried to spin the old rotary dial, but it was rusted to a piece. There would be no calling out. For good measure, I gave the metal cabinet a few small slaps, as though it was an odd sleeping instrument that could be woken in this manner. I set the handle in the rest, and felt a great fatigue. The skin on the back of my hands was redly hot, burnt by the sun. I sat on the wooden floor. Would the phone ring again? Or was this some incredibly rare wrong call? I was not prepared for the answer. Like a stick of dynamite, the phone above me exploded with purpose. I flailed upward and took the handset. "Hello," I gasped. There was a moment of silence on the crackling line, and then a man's voice said, quite seriously, almost sadly, "Is this the policeman?" "The policeman," I said, "a wrong number, surely." "Who is this?" I asked. Again, silence. How difficult would it be to keep the caller on the line? He needed the police and had misdialed. Could I convince him that I, the misdialed, also needed such help? Could my emergency of being stranded in the Badlands be included in his next call to the authorities? But no further conversation was permitted. At my shoulder came an awful pulling, a few hard taps, and then a tugging. I cringed slowly around. I didn't see the man at first, but fixed on his horse, about 10 yards off, a huge black-and-white delusion sniffing at the grassless dust. "Sounds like that might be for me right there," the man drawled, reaching for the phone. There was a gun at his hip. I released the phone and we shuttled around. He had a massive, branch-like mustache straining from his upper lip and wore dusty boots and black jeans and, of course, a great-brimmed 10-gallon or even 20-gallon cowboy hat. "This is the sheriff," he said into the phone. "Now can I be of service?"
"Hey, cowboys, life is a mighty hard life, riding through heat and through cold. But I wouldn't trade all my cow-punching days for all of old Midas's gold. There's horses to break and rustlers to fight, deserts that will make you turn pale. But there's plenty of fun for the son of a gun who can sing and be gay on the trail. Ki-yi, ki-yerpy, ki-yerpy, ki-yo. Ki-yi, ki-yerpy, ki-yerpy, ki-yo. We round up them dogs and drift them along. Them and brand them and doctor the bulls, and we turn them out loose on the range. At night when them doggies is dreaming about cows headed all over the plain, the night riders sit in their saddles and sing for from the dark to the dawn of the day. Kai-ai, kai-er, bi-kai-er, bi-kai-o. Kai-ai, kai-er, bi-kai-er, bi-kai-o.
That's Skip Gorman performing his Song of a Cowboy, and this is Adam's Motion in the Void. For more information on the music and the show, please visit the New Hampshire Public Radio website at www.nhpr.org. This show is made possible through the generous donations of listeners like you. More of this week's story, The Orwell Storyteller, after the break.
I watched the horse quest his muzzle over the lifeless ground. A white palomino, a slab of black and white granite, made flesh. For 2 minutes, the sheriff scribbled notes into a ragged journal book he'd propped against the wall. Though I did my best to eavesdrop on the conversation, the sheriff kept his back to me and drawled softly into his note-taker's hunch. He made a few final marks in his book, hung the phone up, and stepped out of the booth. He clicked his tongue and the horse galloped over to stand massively beside him. He flipped back through the diary, a ponderous labor, as he dabbed a finger to his tongue at every turn of the page. Finally, he looked up. "A few days early, Mr. Corwick," he said. It wasn't really a question, but the only conceivable inevitability from his standpoint. "Actually, I don't think I'm in your book," I said. He reappraised his list, frowning. "What's the name on your reservation?" he asked. "Shoe and Sleeves," I said. "But I can't imagine that you have me on your reservation." The sheriff turned to an empty page, and then, as I watched him, he scribbled my name down and then instantly discovered it. "Ah, here you are, Mr. Sleeves," he said brightly, setting a check mark beside it. "I'm Sheriff Till, Tommy Till, and this is my horse, Mighty." After a moment of staring into his quizzical eyes, I struck out an awkward hand, and he laughed and took it, as I muttered my own name again, "Shoe and Sleeves," as though I hadn't just said it, and he hadn't just written it oddly down. He tightened his hat and stuffed the book in his shirt pocket and gave it the tucked-in pat of a job well done. Then horse and man turned to face me, now with a carry-along congeniality, as though we three should obviously get a move on and go strolling together through the Badlands, two men and a horse named Mighty. "Where might we be heading?" I asked. The sheriff smiled and looked at the horse. "Where are we headed, Mighty?" he asked. The horse snuffed, and the two started off walking. At the outset, as I struggled to keep up, I made a few more of these attempts to find out just what in the world was going on. Was there a town in the adjacent land? If not, what was he doing here? but the sheriff either waved away my questions or redirected them to Mighty Horse with a kind of mystical humor, as though the horse was in charge, as though my curiosity was somehow naughty, aberrant, or misbegotten. "So how'd you hear about us?" he asked finally, after a quiet while. It was a puzzling question, as I'd obviously been trying in vain to hear about them, whoever they might be. "I haven't heard of you," I said dryly. The sheriff came up short and laughed. "It's just a little hard to believe," he said doubtfully. "I'm not pretending," I said. "We don't get many out here who don't know why they're here. No one just shows up, is what I mean." He patted my arm surely, as though he had me with that one. It was exasperating. I threw up my hands. "I'm not pretending," I said again. It was a confusing circumstance. I couldn't find my right perspective. We walked. He had a curious habit of bouncing against the horse's shoulder, using the big animal as a kind of lazy person's walking device. Every so often, he'd look back at me, perhaps checking to see if I was ready to come out with it. "Truth is," Sheriff Till said, after another bit of silence, "it don't matter if you know or don't know what's happening, and I'm not hiding anything from you. Just that it ain't so simple. We gotta let it build into some context." "Context," I said. His use of the word somehow starved me of its meaning. "Let's us three just walk along without any kind of fuss. If you don't know what's happening, then you might miss it." The sheriff rubbed his grizzled face and then painted his two hands across the darkening sky, framing this missable something. The sun was well down behind us, and the sky above us was a purple glass, growing weak and yellow at the sills. It was like a surrealist cowboy comedy where both parties were stuck in mischievously different stories. I hunkered down in my silence. I would wait this out, leaf on the river. "I suppose Neve must have dropped you," he said after a time. "Neve Kimball?" When I nodded, he laughed. "Hardly makes any sense, but she probably saw the book and thought you knew what she was doing. Is that it?" "The book," I said. "Wild guess," he said. "You didn't read chapter 30, did you?" The sheriff pointed to the book in my hand. I was annoyed by this bit of small prophecy. I had, in fact, stopped at the end of chapter 29. Why, was another question. I peered into the dusky sky, trying to recall what exactly had stopped me from reading that last chapter of the book. He bent down and rapped his knuckles on the book cover. "Refresh your memory, why don't you?" he said. With a sharpened irritation, I opened and read the last paragraph of chapter 29, remembering now why I'd stopped. "For these and other reasons," the paragraph began, "I strongly suggest that you stop reading this book at the end of this chapter. Put it down. If in a week or a month you feel inclined to go further with this, then by all means return to the book and read chapter 30. It will ask a lot of you, and to avoid disappointment, I am suggesting this break, this interval, so you may more deeply investigate your own level of seriousness and realize how much or how little you're willing to give up."
In a far-off western country where friends are few and dear, and the cattle roam in thousands, and the skies are always clear, there's a grave without a headstone, with neither date nor name, where my partner sleeps in silence, in the land from which I came. We were rounding up one morning, our work work was almost done when the cattle all stampeded in a mad and fearful run. For the boss's little daughter was holding on one side, rushed in to check the cattle, was a wild and dangerous ride. Beneath the lass's saddle early on that fatal morn, I placed a scarlet blanket, a mistake I'll always mourn. When the cattle saw the blanket, their brains were crucified. They bore down on the lassie. It was there my partner died. The boss's little daughter rode the best horse all around, but it stumbled in a dog hole and throwed her to the ground. The cattle thundered toward her, she surely would have died, but Utah spurred his cow horse like lightning to her side. His pony reached the maiden with a firm and steady bound, and he swung out from his saddle to lift her from the ground. But the strain upon his saddle had not been felt before. The back cinch snapped beneath him, he fell by young Lenore. From the dust sprang Utah Carol, a blanket waving gay. He led out off an angle, and the cattle came his way. My partner turned the stampede, and he saved his little friend. But the maddened cattle rushed him, and he turned to meet his end. His six-gun flashed like lightning, it sounded loud and clear. As the cattle charged upon him, he dropped the leading steer. 1,000 hooves a-pounding, 1,000 slashing horns snuffed out the life of Utah, the bravest cowboy born. Now the boss man's little daughter, she often comes to pray for the man who died so freely to save her on that day. In a far off western country where spirits dare to fly, I know my partner Utah has a home beyond the sky.
I just can't say how amazing it is you're here if it's true. You didn't read chapter 30, the sheriff said. We stopped in the shadows of a towering pinnacle. For the first time, I felt a gentle breeze streaming down from the cliffs above. My attention was drawn to a narrow opening in the rocky bluff ahead, where I now saw the blurring vista of an expansive downdrop. I took a few steps toward this and admired a deep-going amphitheater. The enormous far wall was a smooth arc of red stone, windowed with caverns and roosts cut blackly from the canyon face, like an ancient cave in the cliffs, city. I followed as the sheriff took Mighty's reins, and the two began to sidestep down the slope into the basin. "We don't know who used to live here," he began. "Indians originally, I'm sure, but when we came there was all kinds of debris. Rusty wagon wheels, trash, some old Dakota township, early settlers. It turned it into a kind of stockade, with dungeon doors and the ground apartments. The cells above are open, though. You can still see the remnants of the old, old ladders dangling from the walls." He pointed generally out, but I could only see a few hanging tatters, like horsetails tracing the wall. We came down onto the cleared plateau, and the horse ran off. The sheriff drew me along toward the canyon wall and first floor row of prison cells. In some of the upper apartments, 40 and 60 feet above in the sheer of the wall, I could see the dangling legs of a seated person, or then an unreal figure in alabaster robes crossing back and forth along the threshold. Footprints scuffed the flat land. "That's the mess hall," the sheriff said, pointing to a rounded adobe building. "Do you live here?" I asked, suddenly sensing the release in his voice that signaled he was home. "I do, yes," he said. "I'll show you." He jangled a set of pirate keys and unlocked the first cell door before moving on to the next one and unlocking it. He swung the door wide and stepped in. "I live here in this one," the sheriff said. He lit a large candle and carried it through the room. I could see a small stool, a slab of low wood with a dish and clear jug of water, the narrow, blocky frame of a monk's bed. He laughed at my disbelief. "You can sleep in the first one I opened." He nodded toward the wall. "Should be water in the jug, but you let me know if there's not. A cot there in the darkness. Just keep going back. Blankets, pillow, candle for reading. Matches in the tin on the shelf." He used his own cell to illustrate the layout of mine. I nodded. "Welcome to the Sangre de Cristo," the sheriff said. He gestured with need at the book in my hand, and I opened readily to the end of chapter 29. He dabbed his finger on his tongue and then pressed it firmly on the paper and flipped us to the next page. "Find the matches, light the candle, lay on the bed with the blanket," he said flatly. "And then, Mr. Sleeves, enjoy chapter 30. That should give you all the context your heart desires. And once again, let me welcome you to the Sangre de Cristo, and I hope you consider staying with us for soever how long as you may need." I looked down at the chapter heading, scarcely believing my eyes. In a heavy fog, I went into the cell, found the matches, lit the candle, moved the jug of water close by the heavy bed, and lay beneath the blanket on a mattress made of straw. I unearthed the hard, sticky bun from my pocket and began to read aloud into the small hollow of my cell from the last chapter of the book. Chapter 30, A Pilgrimage to the Sangre de Cristo.
Farewell, green fields, sweet meadows adieu, rocks and mountains, I depart from you. Nevermore shall thine eyes by you. Sad bosom to rest. What have I given such freedom to share, to roam these wild hills and breathe the fresh. Soon must return to my like old prison cell. What's life without liberty is oftentimes said of a poor troubled mind that's often in dread. No sun, moon, or stars upon me now shine. No change in my chamber from daylight till dawn.
Skip Gorman, performing Prisoner for Life off his CD, A Cowboy's Wild Song to His Herd. Well, Skip, thanks so much for joining us this evening.
Well, thanks for including me.
My first impression is, wow, this really sounds authentic.
Yeah, that's great. Great to know, because that's what I pride myself on, you know. That's what I try to do, is transport people back.
Yeah, and it seems like it would be an easy thing to do, but it's about the hardest thing I think you can do, is to be authentic, or sound authentic at least, you know?
You have to grow up with it.
Yeah.
I think, you know, I've never listened. I know who the Beatles are, and I listen to Buddy Holly and Elvis, but if you asked me, you know, I can't even name them.
Right. You can't give examples of a thing you don't know.
Right. Yeah, right.
I guess that's the best way of describing Rolling Stones.
You know, I wouldn't know who they were.
Is that a dislike of the music, or is it more because you want to stay toward the music that you know that's kind of your career?
I think it has more to do with the fact that I really loved acoustic music early on, to the point where I didn't appreciate people who plugged in.
Well, you made the comment that the fiddle was sort of the closest thing to the human voice.
Yeah.
And it seems like in some ways you're saying that music is this human expression, and when you make that move maybe to plug it in, that's the first step away from it being that human expression.
Yeah, well, that's a good way to put it.
Where did this all start for you? Where did your interest in kind of this old-timey music come about?
I grew up in Rhode Island And there were a couple of guys there. We got into this about the same time. And then the Newport Folk Festival came in, and I went to see everybody from, you know, the Kentucky Colonels to all the really old-time guys, Stanley Brothers. And I got to just go nuts over them when I was a young teenager. And so, you know, I just never came back.
So before you had a chance to get into maybe the music of your contemporaries, you were sort of off and running because of what you'd heard at the festival.
And I felt there was something special there, you know, and I felt unique. I think there was part of that growing up, you know, but I just learned that it was something that was, I just sensed it was more real and it wasn't commercial.
Well, it's weird to think of somebody growing up in Rhode Island who somehow can touch that or convey the spirit of such a different world.
Well, yeah, but that's because of the Newport Folk Festival. Another thing that really kicked this off for me was somebody gave me a Jimmy Rogers re-release LP from the late 50s. And that's pretty much the guitar style that I play today. Simple.
And where did you go between listening to the music at the Newport Folk to, you know, picking up a guitar or whatever your first instrument was? When did that sort of take place?
Well, when I was about 8, I had a Stella guitar. And then I got the Jimmy Rogers record, and then I went to the Newport Folk Festival.
And this was probably in the late 50s?
Yeah, very early 60s. And I got into this old-time cowboy stuff out west because it seemed to match the Jimmy Rogers style I had, and I like the ballads. I like the whole idea of ballads that tell stories.
So earlier we were talking about that authentic flavor that your music has, and when you're playing your music, are you sort of, do you feel like you're pretending to be a cowboy, or do you feel like you're sort of tapping into something that is deep within yourself already there?
I think some of both. I kind of try to transport people back in time through the flavor, through the nuance of the music. And I think that's what I just subconsciously at this point in my life try to do. Because here I am, a New Englander living in New Hampshire most of the time, although I do travel around a lot. And
do you ever actually have those, on your website you sort of mention how these are songs that came from, like, the cattle drives or come from around campfires. Do you ever actually have those experiences yourself?
Oh, yeah. I was, for many years in the 90s, in the summertime, I was going to a ranch in Wyoming, actually a couple of ranches. And I was working as a wrangler and helping out at the ranch and performing around the campfires. But we were doing cattle drives that would go on a 90,000-acre ranch.
So you actually have been a cowboy?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Absolutely. Yeah. I ran across some friends in Maine who owned a ranch in Wyoming. And they invited me out there to do some wrangling and singing, and I did it for a long time, for year after year. And so I got a chance to essentially live what I had been singing about.
How did that then affect your music? Did your music change or your sense of it change after you actually lived the life?
I think it must have. It must have, because then I had a better sense of what I was singing about. You know, if I went and sang to cattle at night and did night herding, and I heard them be quiet after I sang the night herding song, it would turn that whole thing into a reality for me.
So you actually sang that song off to the cows in the pasture?
Yeah. It was pretty strange. One night, the cattle were boxed in this canyon, and they were just making a racket. And people kind of dared me to go down there and sing to make the cattle be quiet. So I went down there with a friend, and I sang the night herding song, and you would not have believed it. And when we were done with that song, there was total silence down there.
That must have been a really powerful experience to sort of see the music take hold of this, you know, group of, you know, excited brute animals.
Yeah, and it freaked everybody out, actually.
I feel like that would be very moving. Before you went on these, sort of became a cowboy, I'm assuming you had some sort of, you know, imagined idea of what that would be like. What was the reality like as compared to maybe how you'd been thinking about it for over the years while playing the music?
Well, most people, especially in New England, but all over the country, they say when they think of the cowboys, they think of the TV cowboy, you know, Roy Rogers or Gene Autry, the stuff they grew up on.
Yeah.
And it's all a fantasy. And when kids grow up and see this stuff, they enjoy the excitement of it, but they don't have an inkling of how dangerous it really is. Mm. And while I was out there, I saw broken femurs. Mm. I saw a person get struck and killed by lightning. Mm. I saw a person get have a broken pelvis. I saw a person have half her teeth kicked out. And, it, you know, constantly you hear about these horse wrecks all the time. And anytime you're around there and you have these horses, you have to constantly be on your guard around them. Mm. You know, you can't walk behind them without touching them. You can't, when you go to saddle a horse on the left side, you had better be standing there like you would a lineman on a football field, you know, ready to go. And it's, you know, it's a very dangerous thing, and most people don't know what that's like.
That has never really been communicated in any good way, I don't think. I mean, maybe, but do you feel like your music kind of communicates that as it sort of retells all those stories?
I think it does, because I would say a quarter of the songs I sing are about some kind of horse wreck or death and dying or maiming or injury or that kind of thing. Whereas most people who have the TV version just think they can hop on a horse and drive it around like a Cadillac.
I can imagine the cowboys, you know, playing their music at night around, the, you know, to just as a part of their lifestyle, and then sort of this extension of their job, yodeling out or using it as a kind of a shepherding tool.
Uh-huh.
But I'm wondering how did this music then pass into, you know, the public domain? Were there musicians who came and started recording these songs, or did some of these cowboys then stop being cowboys and start playing their music? How did we come to know about it?
I think it started as stories around the campfire, and then when these stories got good, they would attach some kind of rhyming mechanism, turn it into a poem. And then the third step was to take a melody and put it on that poem so that you have a ballad. And newspapermen and people like Jack Thorpe, and he had gone to St. Paul's School in Concord, New Hampshire. And his dad's business failed, so he couldn't afford to go to college. So he ended up in Nebraska sending polo ponies back to his dad. And that didn't work out, so this kid, after he was 19 or so, headed down into New Mexico and parts of Texas and rode around for 1,500 miles collecting songs in these cow camps right around 1885, around then, in the 1880s sometime.
And how was he collecting these?
He was writing down the lyrics.
Was he writing down the melodies or anything like that, or just
In his collection, there are he doesn't have musical notation. But eventually, you know, over a period of time, people would sing them, and they would come out somehow melodically. But this is a fascinating thing, because he made the first collection of cowboy songs, and 2 years later, John Lomax, Alan Lomax's father, who was a University of Texas professor, did the big collection in 1910 and took a lot of Jack Thorpe's songs and never gave him credit for it and put it in his collection.
So Jack Thorpe was sort of the original folk music gatherer, in a way.
Yeah, you could say that. I mean, I haven't run across anybody else, and anybody involved in this doesn't really know anyone else who had written the things down. beforehand.
The interesting thing that you were, as you were talking about the way that these songs kind of came about, almost accidentally, just people telling stories and then the stories kind of getting revised and then somebody else taking it and maybe putting it to meter or rhythm and then somebody else taking it and setting music to it. Is that sort of why it's called folk music? Because it's kind of a collective work rather than any one person's work?
I think absolutely. I think that is probably what you just gave is a very good definition of folk music. But although, you know, some things that are written by one person can certainly be considered folk music.
Well, I think that's what makes, you know, that kind of universality really shines through folk music. You know, it doesn't feel personally possessed by anyone. You know,
right.
it has that not me, but us. It's like, even though if there's one person playing, one person singing, it does feel like there's a we in there somehow.
That's a great point. You know, where music like bluegrass music has of prime importance the instrumental part, the melodies and the music and the hot picking, a music like cowboy balladry has lyrics as prime. And the lyrics are of primary importance, and people will just find a melody to tack on to those lyrics. A good example is... Each night as I lay on the prairie and look at the stars in the sky, you know, roll on, roll on, roll on, little dogies, roll on, roll on. That song is really My Bonnie Lies Over the Ocean.
Right, right.
And that's a great example of how this stuff gets put together, is they take the lyrics that are made up by people who have lived the life, whether it's about a stumbling saddle horse or loneliness or you know, something important in the day of a life of a cowboy or a cowgirl, and they make a story out of it that becomes a poem that eventually they find a melody for.
I really love that complicated but very natural process. That seems very beautiful. It just seems like that's how to best render something, you know, put it through this long mill.
And it stands the test of time.
Maybe we could hear one more song. I was thinking of the song Good Night, Loving Trail.
Triangle and curse everything. If dirt was a kingdom, then you'd be a king on the goodnight trail, on the loving trail. Your old woman's lonesome tonight, French hearts blowing like a lone bowling calf. It's a wonder the wind don't tear off your skin. Get in there and blow out the light. Cook fire's gone out and the coffee's all gone. The boys, they're all out there raising a dawn. You're just a-sitting here lost in a song on the goodnight trail, on the loving trail. Your old woman's lonesome tonight. French hearts blowing like a lone bowling calf. It's a wonder the wind don't tear off your skin. Get in there and blow out the light. With your snake oils and herbs and your liniments too, do anything that a doctor can do, except find a cure for your own daggone stew on the goodnight trail, on the loving trail. Your old woman's lonesome tonight. Your French heart's blowing like a lone mourning cat. It's a wonder the wind don't tear off your skin. Get in there and blow out the light. I know that someday I'll be just the same, wearing an apron instead of a name. No one can change it and no one's to blame on the goodnight trail. French hearts blowing like a lone bowling can. It's a wonder the wind don't tear off your skin. Get in there and blow out the light. Get in there and blow out the light.
Next week on Adam's Motion in the Void, The Orwell Storyteller Part 3, featuring the very unique and personal music of Peterborough, New Hampshire resident Christine Hayward, in which Sherwin reads Chapter 30 of The Way of Keir Lowry and finds the door to his cell a bit too heavy to open, or even, perhaps, locked.